Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to update a number of different stories that I've covered over the years. Due to the limitations of time, we only have 2 half-hour segments. The supplemental discussion to this, to the items that I'm about to discuss, will necessarily be brief, perhaps too abbreviated to be comprehensible to many of the listeners. This is not in any way to be condescending, but rather to say, in order to flesh out one's understanding of some of the topics that I'm going to be speaking about, one should get a hold of either some of the tapes that I refer to and or some of the secondary sources I refer to in order to, again, flesh out your understanding of some of these topics. Hopefully we will have time, I will have time to give you the address, etc., for Spitfire, the tape duplication service that stocks the various tapes that I've done and which contain the documentation on these various topics. Research credit on the first article goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, and it concerns the tangle of events surrounding the P2 Lodge and the Vatican Bank. In RFA programs 17 through 21, I dealt with some of the power politics surrounding the Vatican and the P2 Lodge and the events surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 1981. Those are available from Spitfire. There are also numerous half-hour segments updating events surrounding the shooting of the Pope, the Vatican banking scandals, and the P2 Lodge. The P2 Lodge was a Masonic lodge, or what was ostensibly a Masonic lodge, headed up by former Mussolini fascist and Waffen-SS officer Dicio Geli, an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration. The P2 Lodge served as what was in effect a crypto-fascist government, which for all intents and purposes ran Italy for much of the post-World War II period. It consisted of powerful Italian political figures, business figures, journalistic figures, military and intelligence officials, and last but most assuredly not least, organized crime figures. One of the latter, Michele Sindona, a P2 member and a mafioso, became the advisor to the Vatican Bank, the IOR. He was succeeded in that capacity after embroiling the IOR in a series of scandals. He was succeeded in that capacity by Roberto Calvi, the head of the Banco Ambrosiano, Italy's largest bank. Calvi, too, was a P2 member, and when the Banco Ambrosiano collapsed in 1982, he was found hanging from Blackfriars Bridge. This is discussed in RFA 18. According to Michele Sindona, the loans which the Vatican Bank had guaranteed that the Banco Ambrosiano had made. The Banco Ambrosiano made a series of bad loans that were guaranteed by the Vatican Bank. Those loans, according to Michele Sindona, went to finance anti-communist activities in Latin America. There were also indications that some of the Banco Ambrosiano funds were used to obtain arms for Argentina during the Falklands War. Roberto Calvi, following the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano, was found hanging in London, and now there is a legal maneuver underway, to exhume his body to see if, in fact, he was murdered, as many suspect. And again, for background on this, RFA 18. Research credit on this goes once again to Dave White. This comes from the Europeans issue of June 29th through July 5th of 1998. This is an article which reads as follows. Another scandal which refuses to lie down is that involving Roberto Calvi, the Italian banker who was found hanging under Blackfriars Bridge in London in 1982. There have always been suspicions that Calvi, known as God's banker because of his connections with the Vatican Bank, was murdered, although the initial inquest verdict was suicide. Last week, a Rome judge ordered Calvi's body to be exhumed at the request of lawyers continuing the investigation, who believe he was strangled on a boat on the River Thames by criminals who had lured him to London. 4 Italians with mafia connections, one of them now dead, are under investigation for allegedly conspiring to kill Calvi in retribution for his failing to repay tens of billions of dollars lent to him by the Sicilian mafia to shore up his failing bank, Banco Ambrosiano. Well, again, the definitive archive show dealing with the Vatican banking scandals is RFA 18, and there are numerous updates about the Vatican banking scandals and the various activities of the P2 available from Spitfire. Research and translation credit on the following also goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. The following is from La Repubblica's issue of May 24th of 1998. This is an article by Marco Politi. It's headlined, Holy See Wants to Avoid Clash Over Abortion, but in fact it refers to a former Wehrmacht and Italian fascist army chaplain who was recently beatified by Pope John Paul II. The article reads in part, In Vercelli yesterday, Pope John Paul II solemnly beatified a local priest, Don Secondo Polo, great educator, industrious preacher, and confessor, and zealous assistant to the youth of Catholic Action. Catholic Action is an extremely reactionary Catholic organization, which in the past has openly collaborated with various fascist powers of Europe in the World War II period, and also has worked for U.S. intelligence. Continuing, Polo, a German military chaplain stationed in the Alps, followed the Wehrmacht into Poland and was killed on December 26, 1941 in Montenegro. An embarrassing detail, since he was following Italian troops into the Balkans, where Axis forces and their collaborators were involved in particularly bloody actions. There was a long history of Vatican collaboration with fascism, discussed in RFA 17 at considerable detail. Anti-communism and, to a lesser extent, anti-Semitism were the common bond between the fascist powers and the Vatican, and this led to very firm support by the Vatican for fascism, despite the fact that the Nazis actively persecuted Catholic priests. Again, a good discussion of that in RFA 17. It's also ironic because one of the ultimate long-term goals of the Third Reich and Nazism is the destruction of the Catholic Church and all of Christendom. More about some of the questionable people that the Pope has been beatifying, this article comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of July 4th, 1998. That was a Saturday. The following is a Reuters story, datelined Vatican City, and headlined, Croatian Cardinal Stepanak decreed a martyr by Pope. Subtitled, He Died Under Communist House Arrest, and again this is datelined Vatican City. It reads in part as follows. Pope John Paul II has decreed that the late Cardinal Alois Stepanak of Croatia, who was imprisoned by Yugoslavia's communist regime after World War II for his alleged fascist sympathies, was a martyr. Stepanak, who will be put on the road to sainthood at a beatification ceremony in October, died under house arrest in 1960. In 1946, the communist government sentenced Stepanak to 16 years of hard labor for his wartime support of Croatia's Nazi-backed Ustasha fascists who killed thousands of Jews, Serbs, and Gypsies. Stepanak, an ardent Croatian nationalist, welcomed the formation of the Ustasha puppet regime in 1941. He has been criticized by historians for not speaking out sufficiently against its atrocities. In fact, Alois Stepanak did not have alleged fascist sympathies. He was an actual member of the Ustaši parliament. The Ustaši were the brutal Croatian fascists who not only collaborated with Hitler, but survived as part of what I have termed the Underground Reich, largely through their collaboration with various Western intelligence services in the post-World War II period. And with the breakup of Yugoslavia and the resulting Balkans War in the early 90s, the old Croatian fascist regime was renewed once again in the, quote, independent unquote, Croatia. It has been maintained by the defenders of Stepanak that he was murdered while in prison. I do not know if that's true or not. It would not surprise me one bit if that was true. Also wouldn't surprise me if that was propaganda. But whether or not he was murdered, he was not an alleged fascist sympathizer. He was an actual seated member of the Ustasha Parliament. And there's a discussion, once again, of the collaboration between the Vatican and fascism in RFA 17. I would note that the Croatian Church once again blessed the Ustasha fascists when the Balkans War began in the early 1990s. Research and translation credit on the following goes to Dave White. Actually, research credit on this goes to Dave White. And this concerns a key witness in the piracy trial of Manzar el-Kassar. Manzar el-Kassar was the key man not only in obtaining East Bloc weapons for the Contras, according to many sources, but also the key man in obtaining American arms for the Iranians during the Iran-Contra scandal. Manzar el-Kassar is a major weapons dealer, a primary supporter of international terrorism, deeply implicated not only in the Achille Lauro hijacking, but also by the Pan Am Insurance Investigators report in the bombing of Pan Am 103. Also a congressional report by Representative Schumer implicates Manzar el-Kassar in the bombing of Pan Am 103. The DEA credits Manzar el-Kassar with bringing 20% of the heroin into the United States each year. And he was one of the main men that the Reagan-Bush White Houses used in the Iran-Contra affair. He was actually on the White House payroll, and his role as an Iran-Contra operative has never been denied by the various operatives in this case. It's interesting, as I speak in early August of 1998, that this has been completely ignored by those who are focusing on the story about the Contra cocaine connection surrounding Gary Webb's Dark Alliance series in the San Jose Mercury News a couple of years ago, and his recent book by the same name. None of them touch on the Manzar el-Kassar connection, and the Iran-Contra players don't even deny his involvement. And again, this man was on the White House payroll, and he was bringing 20% of the heroin into the United States each year and involved in the Achille Lauro hijacking and the bombing of Pan Am 103. It's interesting as we hear the alleged sex scandals of Bill Clinton occupying the news constantly in 1998. You don't hear the people who are beating their breasts righteously over Clinton's alleged sins touching on this, and this one detail is incalculably worse than anything Clinton is even alleged to have done, and most of what he's alleged to have done is obvious BS. However, the cover-up of Manzar El-Kassar continues. One of the things that I discussed in RFA 38, and this was only in the foreign press, it was blocked out in the American, was that Joseph Zapala, George Bush's ambassador to Spain, was actively protecting Manzar El-Kassar from protection by the Spanish authorities. No sooner did Bill Clinton get elected than Manzar El-Kassar was indicted for piracy in connection with the Achille Lauro hijacking. However, he was acquitted when one witness went out a window during the trial. Another witness had two of his children kidnapped, and the DEA evidence was barred from admission into the trial. That witness who had his children kidnapped, Mustafa Nassini, N-A-S-S-I-N-I, was recently murdered. Research credit on this goes to Dave White, and Dave got this from the Sunday Telegraph of June 21st, 1998, and it's on page 28. It's headlined, Achille Lauro Trial Witness Shot Dead. Mustafa Nassini, a Syrian drug trafficker who gave evidence at the Madrid trial of a wealthy arms dealer accused of being involved in the hijacking of the Italian cruise liner Achille Lauro, has been shot dead at his home in the city. At the time of the trial 3 years ago, Nassini's two sons were kidnapped briefly. And again, the cover-up of the monstrous Manzar El-Kassar connection goes on. A very important story was gleaned for us by a listener who got this from the Financial Times of London of July 23rd of 1998. This is an article by Carlotta Gall, G-A-L-L, in Baku, in Azerbaijan, of the former Soviet Union. It's headlined, Chechnya Kidnappers Free Russian Police. I recently did a half-hour segment about the power politics of oil in the Middle East, an altogether cynical affair, and that that program was entitled Trouble on Oiled Waters, and this article makes an interesting supplement to that. The article reads in part as follows. Gunmen in Chechnya have released six policemen seized in a bloody raid on a Russian military base last December and held captive for 7 months in the rebellious republic. The hostages, all members of the Russian police force, were exchanged for three of the attackers who were detained by local authorities at the time of the raid. The exchange is the latest example of Russia's powerlessness in its battle against the well-armed kidnapping gangs operating in the North Caucasus region on its southern rim. After months of refusing the gunmen's demands, the local authorities appear to have given in. Skipping down, speaking of the kidnappers in Chechnya, the breakaway republic of Russia, some of the kidnappers are purely criminal. Others, such as those who seized the policemen, are Islamic extremists, so-called Wahhabis, who are calling for separation from Russia and the establishment of an Islamic state. Remember the name Wahhabi, spelled W-A-H-H-A-B-I. It's critical, and we're going to take a look at that in a second. Continuing, speaking of the kidnappers, they are mostly Chechens and Dagestanis, but are led by a corps of Arab fighters and appear to have international backing, according to, and I'm not going to even attempt this man's name, Mr. Gusayev, Dagestan's Minister for Nationalities and Security Council Secretary. His first name is Magomedsalikh. And note, first of all, that many of these kidnappers have international backing and appear to be, quote, Arab fighters, unquote, and that they are described as Islamic extremists, so-called Wahhabis. Now, to anyone familiar with the geopolitics and power politics of oil in the 20th century, the name Wahhabi will ring very familiar, as well it should. The Wahhabi sect is the ultra-conservative sect of Muslims that rules Saudi Arabia. In fact, King Ibn Saud, the patriarch of the Saudi royal family and the man whose name Saudi Arabia bears to this day, was the head of the Wahhabi sect. And Jack Filby, a British intelligence agent and fascist turncoat, and the son of the father of Kim Philby, also a British intelligence agent who became a Soviet turncoat, Jack Filby elevated Ibn Saud, to the position as head of Saudi Arabia. The founding of the modern Middle East as an oil entity, I guess one could say, a petroleum entity, and in particular the establishment of Saudi Arabia as sort of a petroleum industry province in the Middle East is due more than any other single thing to the collaboration between Jack Filby, again a British intelligence agent who betrayed Britain and became a fascist turncoat, Alan Dulles, an American intelligence operative who also became a fascist turncoat, as exemplified in numerous programs, the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program, the recent half-hour segments entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, and also Connecting the Dots, Alan Dulles, Jack Filby, and King Ibn Saud of the Wahhabi sect basically not only structured the Middle East in the immediate aftermath of World War I in much the fashion that it is today, but they set up the Wahhabi sect, again, from which the Saudi royal family, or to which the Saudi royal family belongs, as the key potentates in Saudi Arabia. A discussion of this is contained in one of the more important books about the power politics of oil and the U.S. intelligence community, a book sadly overlooked, I suspect, because of its title. That book is entitled The Secret War Against the Jews, How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, hardcover edition, St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. It's one of the very best books ever written about U.S. intelligence and the power politics of oil. It has been largely ignored, I suspect, because of the title. People say, I don't like Jews, I don't want to read about Jews. What this is about is what they call in Texas the oil business, and it's one of the most important books ever written about U.S. intelligence, the petroleum industry, and international fascism. Of the collaboration between King Ibn Saud, Jack Filby, who betrayed Great Britain to Ibn Saud, and later Alan Dulles, we will now read in The Secret War Against the Jews. Now, bear in mind that in World War I, the Arab, whether today the Arab states, were part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which was allied with Germany and was fighting against Great Britain. Many people may be familiar with the movie Lawrence of Arabia. T.E. Lawrence was leading the Arab Legion in an armed revolt against the Ottoman Turks. However, King Ibn Saud, acting at the behest to a certain extent of Jack Filby, was fighting against the pro-British Arab forces during World War I. Speaking of this, and bear in mind the name Wahhabis, speaking of this, Loftus and Ahrens write, while Hussein was fighting the Turks for the British, Ibn Saud, the young chieftain of the ultra-conservative Wahhabi sect, was sending terrorist raids against him. Filby, that's Jack Filby, not his son Kim, Filby was supposed to pressure Ibn Saud's dissidents back into line. Instead, it was the beginning of a long and mutually beneficial relationship, which ultimately set Filby against any policy of his own government that conflicted with Ibn Saud's best interests. None of the published histories explains why Filby embraced Ibn Saud with such intensity, or why the equally fanatical king responded with such enthusiasm. According to the versions of several former intelligence officers, Filby and Ibn Saud shared a common hatred of the Jews. When Filby learned of the Balfour Declaration, he took it as a personal affront and made a number of inquiries among his associates in British intelligence. He then informed Ibn Saud that they had both been betrayed by England and turned over classified information from the British Secret Service, including the fact that there will be no Arab nation, only another colonial jewel in the crown. By the way, the Balfour Declaration was the British governmental declaration that established Israel as a state in the immediate aftermath of World War I. That is to say, the declaration was in the immediate aftermath of World War I. And again, note the first sentence, while Hussein was fighting the Turks for the British, Ibn Saud, the young chieftain of the ultra-conservative Wahhabi sect, was sending terrorist raids against him. More about Ibn Saud, Jack Filby, and Alan Dulles in The Secret War Against the Jews. Jack Filby has become an obscure footnote to the history of the Cold War, but his legacy was far from minor. He is one of the lesser-known but most influential persons in the modern history of the Middle East, the renegade British intelligence agent who plucked an obscure terrorist out of the desert and helped to make him the king of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud was very much his creation, and again, that's Ibn Saud of the Wahhabi sect. Filby stole the information from British intelligence files that engineered Saudi control over the holiest shrines of the Muslim world. Jack Filby and Ibn Saud betrayed the British Empire and made the American oil companies economic masters of the region. The man who helped them do it was Alan Dulles, an American spy who had befriended Filby while he was coordinating American intelligence gathering in the Middle East in the first half of the 1920s. Between them, these three men built the very foundations of the modern Middle East. They were the architects of the oil weapon, the instigators of war, the manipulators of history. More important, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Dulles' profits came from the same source. So again, when we look in this Financial Times of London article and hear about the Wahhabis being involved in the kidnappings in Chechnya, I don't think it is too much of a reach to see the power politics of the international petroleum industry in the background of what is going on in some of the former Soviet republics. Those republics, in particular Siberia and some of the Middle Eastern republics, are rich in oil. The Middle Eastern oil pool is declining somewhat. It would appear that the Saudis and probably behind them, the major petroleum companies, have a finger in what is going on in Chechnya and are probably attempting to see to it that some of these former Soviet republics stay former Soviet republics, that is to say they don't ally with Russia, and that their real allegiance would be to the international petroleum industry, as is Saudi Arabia's. Some months back, I covered a story in which there was friction between the Central Intelligence Agency and German intelligence over an alleged CIA spy who was then expelled for allegedly spying against the Federal Republic of Germany. This is an indication of the growing hostilities between Germany and the United States. Recall that the funding for the World Trade Center bombing came from Germany, something discussed in RFA 38. There is a major German connection to the Oklahoma City bombing in the person of Andreas Strassmeier and possibly other German fascists. Strassmeier, the son of Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, Günter Strassmeier, the chief architect of German reunification. That discussed in numerous programs, including the four interviews that I did with Martin A. Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens. There are also numerous updates on the Oklahoma City bombing talking about the Andreas Strassmeier connection. Another article appeared concerning the growing hostility between the United States and Germany, in particular as regards the intelligence field and industrial espionage. This one concerning a tiff not between the CIA and German intelligence, but between the FBI and German intelligence. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White. This comes from the Europeans issue of February 23rd through March 1st of 1998. This is an article entitled Spy Wars. It reads, Cold War spies may be going out of business, but industrial espionage is on the increase. A war of words over whose spies on whose company has broken out between the American FBI and the German Chancellor's Department. A report in the U.S. Journal Public Administration, which accused Germany of being active and successful in industrial espionage, has reignited a row that broke out last year when an American diplomat was expelled from Germany, accused of spying. Bernd Schmidbauer, minister in the Chancellor's Department, said he was astounded by the reports. But Germany's Federal Intelligence Services, for which his office is responsible, has 6,000 staff located around the world, costing $385 million annually. Schmidbauer retaliated in veiled language, suggesting that it was not only East European spies who were tapping into German companies' databases, he meant the Americans. Well, industrial espionage is being carried out around the world, and in the age of the weapons of mass destruction, broad frontal warfare is obsolete, and corporate warfare and economic warfare is front and center, as evidenced in, among other programs, my discussions about the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization. In fact, the Germans commit a great deal of industrial espionage, according to Professor Wilhelm Stauffer, a consultant whose work I accessed some years back. One of the major areas of German espionage around the world is the Goethe Institute. I cannot confirm that myself, but Professor Stauffer is something of an expert in the field, and it is his allegation that the Goethe Institute is a major front for German spying around the world, and the major German corporations such as Siemens right here in the Silicon Valley are major epicenters of industrial espionage. This article, the second article about friction between an American intelligence or law enforcement agency and the Germans, is very significant. We now have the Germans conflicting with CIA and FBI, and it is an indication that the battle lines of World War II are being redrawn. As I've said in the past, the main area of conflict now is the conflict between Germany and the United States on the world stage, and to a lesser extent between Germany and Britain, sort of a conflict between, I guess one could say, Germania versus Anglo-Saxonia. A blockbuster article, an article that is incalculably important and that once again deals with an intelligence conflict between the United States and Germany, was researched for us by a listener who got this from the Electronic Telegraph. Their webpage is www.electronictelegraph.co.uk. electronictelegraph.co.uk. Once again, www.electronictelegraph.co.uk. And this concerns a major conflict between the EU, which is dominated by Britain, and Great Britain, dominated by Germany. And this concerns the National Security Agency listening post in Menwith Hill in Yorkshire. This article is by Simon Davies. It's headlined, EU Simmers Over Menwith Listening Post. It's subheaded, Britain faces a major battle in Brussels over the, quote, security, unquote, deal that gives U.S. spies access to sensitive commercial information. And again, the article is by Simon Davies. And this, by the way, is from the Electronic Telegraph of July 16th. Of 1998. And again, their webpage, www.electronictelegraph.co.uk. The article reads in part, the European Commission is discreetly gearing up for one of the most controversial legal battles in its history. At the heart of this impending battle is the right of one country to spy on another. Specifically, whether Britain has the right to allow the Americans on its soil to eavesdrop on Europe's telecommunications. A European Parliament study, first reported in Connected last December, confirmed the existence in Britain of a network of spy bases operated by the U.S. National Security Agency, the world's biggest signals intelligence organization. The report, assessing the technologies of political control, states, quote, within Europe, all email, telephone, and fax communications are routinely intercepted by the United States National Security Agency via the crucial hub at Menwith Hill, unquote. The activities at Menwith Hill in North Yorkshire had been known for decades, but were never formally acknowledged. Successive attempts by British MPs to raise the matter in Parliament brought forth only bland answers from ministers. The publication of the report confirmed for the first time that the NSA had established a surveillance capacity over the entire European communications network. It also described a grid of supercomputers known as Echelon, capable of scanning vast areas of the communications spectrum to detect keywords. Of particular interest to security analysts was the report's assertion that the NSA was beefing up its commercial espionage activities. In other words, one of Menwith Hill's key roles in the interception of sensitive traffic relating to takeovers and investments. Skipping down. Strictly speaking, the Commission does not have a mandate to regulate or intervene in national security matters. However, it does have a responsibility to ensure that security is harmonized throughout the EU, and this is where the formal protests are likely to emerge. Title V of the Maastricht Treaty specifies, quote, member states shall inform and consult one another within the Council on any matter of foreign and security policy of general interest in order to ensure that their combined influence is exerted as effectively as possible, unquote. Whether the commercial espionage activities at Menwith Hill can be defined as, quote, security of general interest, unquote, will depend on a definition yet to emerge from the Commission. For Britain, this will be vitally important. If the NSA's activities are deemed to be of a general security nature, then Britain has fallen foul of its obligations under the treaty. But if these activities are not deemed to be security issues, then the special relationship between the UK and the US may have to be reviewed, since Britain might not be able to continue to offer the NSA the cloak of secrecy it has hitherto enjoyed. Either way, any referral on the matter by one country will put both Britain and America in a delicate diplomatic position. Indeed it does, and I think that this attempt by the EU translate Germany, reading between the lines, to close down Menwith Hill is tantamount to an act of war. We're going to continue with this article in our next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.